Hey, everybody, this is Kate.
Hey, it's Devin.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
Do, 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 do.
There she is again.
December.
It is, and it's great to be back in the pod.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Mele Kalikimaka.
Oh my God.
Mele Kalikimaka.
I love
whatever
that.
Say.
Yes.
Hanukkah's gone. Come and gone. Happy Hanukkah. How many more are there?
There are a lot, and we don't know them all, and I'm so sorry that we don't know them all. We need to know them better.
That's why I started with happy holidays.
Oh, you're such a smart girl. Oh my gosh, you guys.
This time it's what? Not even 11 o'clock in the morning. We don't have Truly today, guys.
No, it's coffee day.
Nice, warm coffee.
Yeah, we can't really drink Truly at 11 in the morning.
It's a weekday. This is a very rare for us to get together on a weekday.
So I'm super clink. I hope you guys heard the clink.
Cheers to that.
It was a good one.
Oh, I was just telling Kate how I spent 2.5 hours wrapping Christmas presents.
I have spent 0 hours wrapping Christmas presents, so good for you. And I am so behind that it's really stressing me out.
This is my first year of really having to, like, you know, my son now is understanding what Christmas is and Santa Claus.
I love that. It's so magical.
It's beautiful, but now it's like, oh my God, there's effort. Like, I had to have Santa paper and make sure that mommy and daddy didn't have the same paper as Santa Claus.
Oh, no.
And
you think you would have figured that out?
I don't know, but I figured I have to start practicing because next year he might. So it's like,
wait a minute.
Look at the kinks.
Do you have to hide an elf?
Not
hide an elf, but do you have to move an elf every day? Did you notice in my living room that
I missed it?
The elf is hanging off of the ceiling fan today. Okay. And every day I just have to make sure that I can sneak back down here. My kids love it. Every day it's like, where's the elf? Oh my gosh,
where
he moved.
He's
so funny. I mean, the inner workings of my beautiful brain or Pinterest. One or the other.
How many nights have you gone to bed going, fuck the elf?
Oh my God. So many nights. And then those are the days that I like pray that in the morning I remember to run downstairs and move the elf, because God forbid I forget to move the elf. It is devastating for my children if the elf does not move.
See,
what did we do wrong?
I feel like next year will be the first elf year in my household for
kids. You're going to love it.
So
I actually really love it.
Understanding right now, Christmas is presents, and
yes,
you know, so it's like,
and Santa.
But I kind of want to save something for when both kids can understand it.
That is absolutely understandable.
Yeah. All right.
Gosh.
So we're going to get into it. Enough about the Christmas talk.
This is why we're drinking coffee. Okay, you guys. So
what do we have for us today, Kate?
Today we are going to be talking about the notorious Jeanine Jones.
Jeanine Jones.
This lady is a convicted serial killer. She is responsible for up to 60 infant deaths of infants and children that were in her care during the 1970s and 80s. The exact number is unknown.
Trigger warning.
Yeah, so big trigger warning. Thank you, Devin.
You're
across
welcome.
This entire episode. This was really, really rough for me to get through the research. This was really a lot. This obviously involves infant death, child loss. Now, some of this is pretty distressing to hear, obviously. I will discuss what I can, revealing sort of as little graphic detail as I can, but still wanting to express.
I guess you gotta give it to us.
I just
give it to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, I wanna still express like the gravity of what she did out of respect for the victims. So I'm gonna try and avoid getting real graphic with it. And due to the sheer magnitude of her crimes, I won't be discussing each and every single case, but I will touch on as many as I can while we get through this. And I'm
so
not.
You said 60.
60 is what we are estimating.
Wow.
Not all of those have been confirmed, and we'll talk about that.
Okay.
So, but I'm not regarding any single death as more or less important or impactful than the other, just so everybody knows. So this may end up being two parts too, just as a heads up, but we're going to kind of see how this goes. If I feel like we're somewhere in the middle and it's been a long time, I'll stop it and we'll do another part.
I think that's perfectly fine. Okay. I have no words.
Devin, take it. Let's all just take another sip of coffee. Hold
on.
Coffee
so
break.
Listen, you gave me my choice of mugs. And I decided that I couldn't drink out of your husband's face on that mug.
But now I'm
regretting it because I see it's the bigger cup.
You should have now drank out of my...
Your face looks good.
So Brad's face always looks good, just to clarify. Again,
need a David mug. I need David Christmas.
So if any of you are fans...
I need a mug with your face.
If any of you are fans of The Office, my husband and I gifted each other a couple years ago the mugs from The Office that have like the blue star with the face in the middle that are hysterical. And I'll post a picture of it because they're very cute. So mine was dirty, so I'm drinking out of my husband's face today. And so I gave Devin a choice when she came over. I said, I'm going to pour you coffee. And one of my preceptees, my nurse practitioner colleagues, girl, you know who you are. You gave me this mug and I don't tell you this enough or at all, but I do love it and I drink out of it all the time. It says other NP preceptors and it's a picture of a horse. And then it says you and it's a picture of a unicorn on a stripper pole. And I love it with every fiber of my being.
Who doesn't need a unicorn on a stripper pole?
Literally, I feel like everybody needs that. So anyway, now that we've discussed my very eclectic mug collection, now let's talk a little bit about Janine Jones. So we're going to start with her early life. So Janine Ann Jones was born July 3rd, 1950, and was immediately given up for adoption, as many, many kids are. Shortly after she was given up for adoption, she was adopted by a couple named Dick and Gladys Jones, and they were from San Antonio, Texas. Now, they already had three other adopted children of various ages. Aww. So she was their fourth adopted child.
Good for them.
Yeah, I know, right? So Dick was an avid gambler, a serial entrepreneur with multiple failed business ventures. And he was real sort of just like loose with money. The family kind of jumped around.
Not most gamblers.
In general, unless you're like really good at it, like really good at it. So he was a little, you know, the family kind of struggled financially because of this, because it was like highs and lows that they were living on. Yeah. So reportedly, as Janine grew up, she sought approval like aggressively from her family members, but just never really felt like she got it. And she felt like an outcast as early as she can remember. And she always felt never really like one of the family. And she...
What do you think? Any idea?
I don't. You know
what made her feel that way?
I was like, maybe it was because she was the adopted kid, but all of the kids were adopted. So. And she wasn't the only girl. So I'm not really sure to tell you the truth. And, you know, you can only just assume, and maybe it's something that, you know, wasn't apparent in the research, like a thing that happened or whatnot. But she just really always wanted, in particular, her father's approval. And it may have been that he really wasn't much of an emotional guy and that he didn't really give a whole lot in terms of approval to the kids, like routinely. And I didn't hear that he was a bad father. I didn't hear that he was abusive. He was present in their lives, but maybe just the instability of jumping around.
Right.
And, you know, I think there was maybe a lot of different factors there.
Right.
So she was desperate for any kind of attention, like big or small, positive or negative, is what people say. So one of her brothers' names was Travis, and these two were very, very close. They were the closest among
Travis
the siblings. Travis and Janine were very close. And she really confided in him. So all of her feelings, she kind of just vomited upon poor Travis here. Uh-huh. And she really had really terrible self-esteem also. And as
kind of
she...
seeing a theme, and as we're getting into a few episodes of podcast, I'm seeing a theme between some of our subjects that we've decided to talk about.
And you are going to get some real hard Cullen vibes like through
already starting.
And it's, exactly. Yeah. So it is interesting to kind of see these little patterns.
Yeah.
So, but again, not all people that come from these homes that are less than stable grow up to murder people. So, I mean, what are you going to do?
This is true.
This is true. So,
especially when you've taken an oath to help people.
I know. I mean, really? So, as she was growing up into like her tween years, she was short in stature. As she grew, became a little overweight. She never really regarded herself as like particularly attractive. So all of this just sort of compounded her poor self-esteem. And she confided all of this in her brother, Travis. And he was really a big support system for her. So as she got older and into her early teens, she started getting caught in all these little, like, self-inflating lies. And it was constant. I mean, she would lie about literally anything and everything. And it was, like, so blatant. It was really easy to catch her in these lies. And she was caught sort of being really manipulative and attention seeking.
This is as a tween, right?
And so this is an early teen.
Early, so like, yep. 13, 14.
Yeah. So early teen years. And so as she got older, you know, this just sort of got a little bit more obvious. And she was often betraying people. So she would, like, build a relationship with some friends or make a friend and then just, like, turn around and betray them somehow or tell their secrets and just...
Who do you think she got that behavior from? Like, I would think at some point she'd have to observe that.
You would think so. And I'm not sure exactly if, did she observe it or was this just such desperate attention-seeking behavior that she didn't know what else to do because she was so desperate for that validation and that love and that attention that she obviously was not getting anywhere else in her life. You know, we're in her early teens. She's lying constantly. She's destroying essentially every friendship that she makes, which is further alienating her.
And that's such a fragile time.
Oh, God. Too. It's so critical.
Early teens, especially as a young girl, it's such a fragile state.
Absolutely.
To
and
start
she's.
Off that way. It really frames your adulthood.
It really does. And she's just so critically, you know, deficient in attention that she's just alienating herself completely. It's very sad. So. Now, Travis, at 14, the age of 14, was tragically killed in an accident.
Oh.
Listen to what happened. He was attempting to assemble a pipe bomb, which, what the fuck, in their father's garage, and it blew up in his face. So he was transported to Methodist Hospital in San Antonio, where he died just before midnight on that day. Now... 1 year later, their father died of cancer. So this entire year was devastating for Janine.
So she lost her older brother.
Yes.
Who was like her...
Her male role model in her life. And her one confidant. And her father, whose attention she craved for her entire life...
Always wanted it. And
was
gone.
Yep, was gone. So this was absolutely just... Absolutely.
You're doing it again. You are making me sucked into having so much empathy for them.
Girl, you just hold on to your butt.
You just did it again.
Hold on to your butts, everybody. This does not end well. Okay. So in the years that followed, the lying and the acting out did continue. She was constantly seeking attention, mostly from boys. And this led to her, as she got older, being very sexually promiscuous.
I was going to say, I can see you about to tell me promiscuity.
Yes. Then. Which... I mean, you do you. If you're just throwing it everywhere, like, good for you. Live
but
your
again,
life.
I mean, at this time, if she was adopted in 1950, this is mid-60s.
This is not the norm. Nope, this is not the norm. Right. So back in this day, this was very, very seen essentially as like a very shameful thing. And she did not try to hide this. She bragged about it and talked about it to anybody who would listen. Mm. Any exploit that she had, she'd be like, I had sex with him and I had sex with him.
I did that.
I did that. And she was like a collector of exploits, of sexual exploits. Now
she was doing the own notches on her belt.
Yes, she really was. So now when she reached age 16, she had a boyfriend that she was very infatuated with.
This makes me sad for any...
It's very sad. This whole thing is really just very sad. Just a nonstop sad party. So buckle in, everybody.
To do all that,
it does not get better.
16.
It does not get better. So she really wanted to get married at the age of 16. Now her mom, Gladys, who had been...
This is like some One Tree Hill shit.
I know. But we're not rooting for these people to get married like we were back in the day. So her mom, Gladys, was like, hell no, you are 16. And so she waited, of course.
Thank you, Gladys.
As she graduated at age 18, she married her then boyfriend, Jimmy Delaney Jr.
Was this the same boyfriend that she went to marry at 16?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Now, he was a high school dropout who ended up going to join the Navy soon after they married. So he left essentially right after they married. And during this time, Janine had multiple affairs. She had to get it somewhere. Her husband was not around.
Oh,
so
God,
she just
girl.
Was wanted all that male attention and just was grabbing anything that was available. So by all accounts, she was very sexually voracious. And I mean, just marriage like did not stop this. And so when Jimmy was gone, she was just off doing her thing like she was single, essentially. Now, her mom.
So then it makes me wonder why did she want to get married? Because it obviously wasn't for the
one. I think because she wanted that attention and that person to focus all of that attention on her. Now, this is just me.
I mean, he's in the Navy, so that failed.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a theory, though. Like, she wanted that person who felt like she was, you know, walking on water.
You always have that person
who will give you attention. You. Exactly. So I think that's what she wanted, and that's what she envisioned marriage would be like, that she would just lock him down forever and he would always worship the ground she walked on. But he went away to the Navy and it really just was not as she envisioned. Very sad. So her mom kind of knew all of this, because she bragged to everybody who would listen about the people that she would sleep with. And she was starting to encourage like a distraction. She's like, you know, your husband's away in the Navy. Maybe you should do something for yourself and get some education. So Janine then started training at Mims Beauty School as a beautician. And Mims Beauty School just sounds really fabulous and very much for the time.
I want to meet Mim.
Like, I feel like she runs a tight ship.
I picture, like, if we're close to the late 60s, early 70s,
yes.
Like, I picture just this big haired little
100% maybe a beehive.
The cat eye glasses.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Big
Mim.
Old cigarette. I'm Mim.
But also, she takes no shit and she runs a fucking tight ship.
I'm sure.
In that beauty school. This
her.
Is what I picture as yes. well. I love it so much. I love it. So, and she graduated. She did really well. And shortly after she graduated, she had her first child, Richard, named after her father. And this was at age 21.
Not a clue who the father is.
So Jimmy had returned at that point from the Navy, and presumably it's his. Do we know for sure? I don't think we do.
Okay.
So 4 years into the marriage,
21
they did.
Has a baby.
Yeah, 21 has a baby.
Okay.
4 years into the marriage, they did divorce. And this was in June of 1974. Now, they did have periods of reconciliation after, though. And she did become pregnant with another child, Crystal, who was born in 1977. She says, yes, it's Jimmy's. We don't know that for sure because she also had affairs in between. Mm-hmm. Now, while she was pregnant with Crystal, her daughter, is when she started considering a different career, mainly because she was nervous about all of the chemicals from, like, the perms and all of the hair doing stuff, which, like, I mean, it's nice that she's concerned about this baby.
Right.
Because, as we'll see a little later on, that concern really, you know, goes the other way. So at this point is when she decided to enlist in nursing school. So she left her two kids sort of under the care of her mom, Gladys, who she lived with at the time, like a lot of the time. So she would go off to work. Mom Gladys would take care of her two small children. So she would go to work in school and Gladys would sort of be her babysitter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in June of 1976, shortly before the birth of her daughter, is when she enrolled in San Antonio Independent School District's School of Vocational Nursing.
Okay.
Now, vocational nursing is a field that is similar to, you know, a registered nurse. When you graduate, you become a licensed vocational nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Today's world calls it a licensed practical nurse.
LPN.
Exactly. Yep. But back in the day, it was called an LVN.
Correct.
Or a licensed vocational nurse.
Yep.
So this scope of practice is slightly under that of a registered nurse for people that aren't familiar. Now, she did awesome in school. She like killed it. She graduated in May of 77 and she passed with flying colors.
Oh,
and she actually scored like way above a passing grade on those boards back in the day. I mean, she did great. She was great.
Good for her.
Yeah, good for her.
That must have given her some good self-esteem. Single mama too.
Yes.
Rockin' nursing school.
Just really turning her life around and giving herself a purpose.
Yeah.
And doing really well at something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But classmates and coworkers reported she was always very sexually inappropriate. And she would just like watch someone walk by. Like she was in nursing school and clinicals, and like a handsome physician would walk by and she'd be like, she would literally just say to people she would even barely know, she'd hey, be like, doc. No, not even. You know what she would say? I'd fuck his brains out. This is a direct quote. I'd fuck his brains out. If subtle. Some woman
subtle,
if I was in clinical on a nursing floor and some woman who I'd met once or twice before said, hey, you see that guy over there? I'd fuck his brains out. I'd be like, okay. I mean, you do you, but also yikes. That's just a lot. Like, she just had no boundaries.
My sister's favorite saying is, I'd climb him like a tree.
Oh, my God. I love that movie so much.
I'd climb him like a tree.
I don't want to climb you like a tree. I fucking love it. So, I mean, her boundaries obviously were just completely non-existent. She had zero boundaries whatsoever. So, the lying and the betrayals of friendships continued, and she was really just unable to hold on to, like, any relationship. She lied about anything and everything. So, soon after Crystal was born, she began working, because remember, she had just graduated school. Mm-hmm. Now, September 1977 is when she began at Methodist Hospital, which in San Antonio, and that's the same hospital that her brother died at.
Oh,
I know.
Sad.
I know. So she started there in the cardiac ICU. And by all accounts, her supervisors reported, you know, initially she was very motivated, very enthusiastic. She wanted to learn. She wanted to get better. And over time, though, she started getting like a little brazen, a little ballsy. And at her 6-month performance review, there's a direct quote that reads, she is making decisions that she neither has the authority nor experience to make. Mm. So she, at this point, was starting to try and go up and above, you know.
Doing things probably either at the RN level.
Exactly.
Or
at the physician level, yeah. Or what have you. Like, yeah. Just really kind of going.
Outside the
going,
scope of practice.
Pushing her luck a little bit. This is not the way to go, people. No. We don't do this. So she was actually let go in April of 1978 after there was an incident involving how she treated a patient. Now, I couldn't find a whole lot of detail on exactly what happened, but essentially, patients were allowed to smoke in the hospital back in the day because everybody smoked, right? Right. So there was like an area that patients mm-hmm. could like wander out with their IV poles and like
as
go have a fucking
oxygen.
Smoke. Well, even if they were, they'd be like, meh, you know. What are you going to do? So
just don't combust.
Just don't catch on fire, please. So apparently she like Janine like went and found her patient who was an ICU patient. She was in the smoking area, as many apparently ICU
that
patients are
sense.
Back in the day. That's just what you did.
Are you that critical?
I know, right?
You couldn't walk to
the Do you belong
area?
in the cardiothoracic ICU if you are physically able to hold a cigarette and smoke? Many ICU nurses will say, hell no. Get them to the floor.
Yep.
So Janine like ordered her to get back to her room and allegedly was being like a little too physically rough when taking her vital signs.
Hitting the abuse line.
Yes. And the patient like complained about her and she apparently went back to the hospital to talk with the patient when she was not on the schedule. So she like drove to the hospital on one of her off days and was just like, oh, I just wanted to talk because we had like a confrontation moment. And apparently the patient like started crying and having an anxiety attack. I don't know what was said, but it culminated in like the patient having chest pain, needed an EKG and troponins. It was a mess. So anyway, after that incident, obviously she like kind of crossed a little bit of a line and was fired. So this was 8 months at her first nursing job. Right. Now, at this time, it goes without saying, but this is a trend, that San Antonio was in a severe nursing shortage. So getting a job.
Can we just say when is there never not a nursing shortage?
There's always been a nursing shortage. I think
it will be in every story we present.
It basically will. Any story involving a nurse mm-hmm. that murders people mm-hmm. will be like, no, the hospital was desperate for staff. So
we had too many people.
We had too many. Exactly. Now, I think we're always perpetually in like a little bit of a shortage at least, but I think certain areas of the country in certain times are like maybe a little worse than others. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Now, in May of 1978, she began working at Community Hospital in San Antonio. Now, this hospital was smaller. It was a private facility. And she got a gig working the 3-11 shift in obstetrics and gynecology. Now, unfortunately, this job didn't work out either, this time because Janine had decided to take an elective tubal ligation. Like, she decided to have an elective tubal ligation and chose to do this when she was so new that she had yet to accumulate any sick time, so she was forced to resign. So I don't think she necessarily did anything wrong. She just didn't last there because she was like, oh, I'm going to have my tubal right now. And it's like, you couldn't have, like, put that. I mean, I don't think it was anything that was medically necessary. Okay. At least I don't think it was. I could be wrong. But that's what I found out.
All right.
So now she's applying to her third nursing job in 13 months. And she gets a job at Bexar County Hospital. Now, Bexar County Hospital cared for a lot of San Antonio's underserved population. Now, this neighborhood, there was a lot of poverty. There was the hospital itself had a real, you know, crappy reputation because of their population, they had a really small budget. And they had a high staff turnover. Their wages were kind of poor. And basic care, like, you know, hygiene, all of that just kind of suffered because they just, first of all, there was a shortage. And second of all, they couldn't hold on to staff because they couldn't compete with wages.
And it all goes hand in hand. You know,
exactly.
If their population is, say, like Medicaid.
Exactly.
You know, or uninsured.
Exactly. Or... Now, this community in particular also had a large population of Mexican Americans. And
you're down in Texas.
Yeah, you are down in Texas in San Antonio. And there's, I think, this particular neighborhood, though, was
just more than
more so than the average for the area. So in October of 1978, she began working there in their pediatric intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. So during her orientation, her precepting RN, Sherilyn Pendergraft, recalls an incident early in her employment when a six-day-old infant with necrotizing enterocolitis away. Now, this is a life-threatening condition that can affect infants, and essentially it's a bacterial infection of the bowel.
I was going to say, it's basically eating away her colon.
Essentially, right? that's exactly what happened. Now, this, and it does affect newborn babies. Mm-hmm. And now this 6-day-old infant passed away and Janine lost her mind. I mean, she went berserk. I mean, all of us as nurses, of course, all of us as nurses would be devastated. But she... But this was a little over the line. She apparently stared at this baby for hours. So, I mean, even as someone who would be devastated if that were my patient and I was a new nurse, you know, staring at the baby for hours to me does seem a little abnormal. Again, coping is different. You know,
it comes to mind as like, is it creepy? Well, no, like she's in shock
Yeah, she just kind of stared.
Overly emotional.
Yes.
But then also in nursing, as much as we try to not mix our emotions into it, our emotions get into there.
Of course they do. Yeah, of course. And I think any of us who've cared for another human being have been emotional, you know, at a time. So, you know, the incident was a little weird, but her preceptor was like, okay, when, you know, it's new nurse. This is her first infant death. I mean, for anybody, that's traumatic.
I couldn't imagine.
It's traumatic. So nevertheless, over the next few months, she did do well and she impressed other staff members with her skills. And in particular, she became known as like the big guns when it comes to IVs.
Oh,
and I mean, starting an IV on an adult can be really challenging.
Yeah.
At starting an IV on a newborn or an infant.
God, no. Thank you.
Something that is close to impossible.
I was going to say, because usually in those, it's all in the forehead, right? The forehead.
Not necessarily. No, they do them in the arms and the hands and in the feet also.
Okay. I always just picture like the, you know.
Yes. On top of and sometimes head. They will do that if there's no other vessel. But so yes, you're right. But so she was really, really good at this. This was like her thing, her one skill that she really honed. Good for her, because that is a challenge for sure. So, you know, other nurses would call on her if they had a baby, you know, that really needed an IV. They would say, oh, go get Janine. She'll get it.
Good for her.
So every time a baby passed or didn't do well, she got emotional. And I mean, every staff member, like we said, does get emotional, but this was a little more so than average. You know, she would just like, you know, act a little obsessive about the kids when they passed.
Okay.
Now she starts getting a little ballsy here, and
for the normal person that might mean maybe this isn't the right area of the hospital for me to work in.
Sure, exactly.
But for Janine.
For Janine, I think a lot of this, and we'll see this, but I think a lot of this was not real. It was another play. It was wanting attention from coworkers and other staff members and the male coworkers, the physicians. But we'll talk about that.
All right.
So she started getting a little ballsy here. Now she started putting in and carrying out orders and tests all by herself. And she was setting IV drip rates like faster than instructed. She miscopied drug orders, and many of her mistakes resulted in pretty serious medication errors.
Well, because she's not credentialed to do that.
No, and almost all of them like reached her patients. Like, this was a critical issue. And she started, you know, start collecting incident reports in her name. Now, it became apparent to other staff that she was really getting way too attached to her patients. And sometimes at the end of her shift, she would refuse to leave. Well, I mean, any nurse, you know, I get attached to my patients too. And I've never refused to leave when it's my time to leave. I'm picking up my shit.
I guess I could picture this, like, say you've taken care of a baby day after day after day and they're not doing well. And you think, like, this could be the night that they go.
Yeah.
And I get maybe that. Their parents aren't there, or maybe they are, and you just want to sit there. But
there have been some nights when I voluntarily stayed on like the labor and delivery. Like if there's a lady that I was caring for 12 hours who labored and she was literally about to like push out
you
the baby,
wanna be there.
I would stay for an extra hour and help her push because we've developed a rapport.
Yes.
I feel like she needs me. I've done that.
Nothing
so that I get.
Yeah.
But she just refused to leave, and she would just, like, cry, they need me. I can't leave because they need me. And it was everything. She had just, like, some very dramatic outbursts, like, regularly. This was just, like, drama was, like, her personality.
There goes Janine again.
There goes Janine being a friggin' weirdo. So September of 1979 rolls around. She shows up hammered in the PICU. She was not scheduled to work.
Oh, God.
But she just, like,
that's
waltzed
never a good
in
idea,
there.
People. Do no, not show up to work.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't. No. So picture this. Like, close your eyes. So she shows up, staggers into the PICU in street clothes because she's not scheduled to work. She goes into a drawer. She grabs a syringe, goes into the room of one of her patients, and starts just, like, fucking around with their drips. This was a patient that she had cared for the previous day. And she just, like, blew into this patient's room and was like,
no, this
is all wrong.
Now.
She just starts, like, screwing around with her drip rates and stuff.
Oh, God.
Her actual nurse was like, what?
I was going to say,
excuse
so she's
you?
Not in scrubs.
No.
Like, she could be, like, it's not like.
It's not
like,
funny
like,
at
oh,
all.
This
it's not,
is not
funny.
You're not supposed to be here.
It's not funny at all for that poor patient and their family. But I it's hard. Like, picturing that is just, like, I have no, that's my natural reaction is to laugh because I don't know what else.
Well, I think it's because of how ridiculous
it's just
it
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's absolutely ridiculous. So, so anyway, that was real weird.
So that happened.
Yep. Now, despite all of these events, she was never fired. She was issued a formal commendation from the hospital, for her dedication to the ICU for picking up a lot of extra shifts. She lied and manipulated herself out of trouble routinely. So all of these medication errors, all of these incident reports, she just showed up and she did all the work. And so everyone was like, I mean, Janine, she grinds, man. Let's keep her on because she'll show up. And so let's get into when things start to get a little dicey.
Because it sounds like they're starting that way.
You know, things start dicey, they end real dicey.
Oh, boy.
So staff starts noticing at Bexar that she's scarily prepared when things start to go south with her patients. So during codes, she would, like, already have all the meds drawn up. And she would just, like, walk into a room with, like, the doctor and several nurses there. And she would just take a syringe out of her pocket and just push it. And the doctor would be like,
what did you just do?
What are you pushing? And she'd be like, oh, I just had a feeling. It's calcium. And he was like, okay. Like, you know, whatever. So
obviously she was planning these.
And it was not like she just had that gut feeling. Like, sometimes your patient's doing poorly and it's like, this guy's circling the drain. He's going to code. It was like she already had everything ready. And, like, she knew. Like, she knew it was going to happen.
Because she planned
because it. Because she planned it. So, at Bexar Hospital, she encountered Dr. James Robotham. Now, he was the medical director of the PICU there. Dr. James Robotham. So, he was a hard ass, but a very skilled pediatric intensivist. Now, the two of them hit it off because she's super manipulative and she can just kind of slide right in there. And if there's someone that she really wants
she wanna fuck to be close too.
With... Probably. She would do that to literally anything with a penis and a pulse. So anybody, though, that she really wanted to be close to, she made it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, she would make sure she didn't burn that particular bridge mm-hmm. because she could use them later. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So she lied and manipulated herself, you know, into his good graces. So they hit it off. Initially, he really trusted her because she was pretty skilled at certain things. And she seemed to really just get shit done when it comes to codes and just like know exactly what needed to be done because she knew what was going on. And she often would go to work and request to care for the sickest and most complex patients.
Oh, boy.
And she'd be like, give them to me, you know, that this person has, you know, this really complex neonatal patient. I want that patient. I don't want the other one. And the other nurses were like, well, okay, whatever. So she was still routinely insubordinate. You know, she would, like, challenge her coworkers. Now, there were, at this time, a few LVNs that worked on the floor in this ICU. Remember, she's an LVN. And these days, we really don't have LPNs working in this setting.
No, right.
And, you know, this was still a thing back in the day. But they would always have a registered nurse or two on each shift. And a registered nurse would always be the charge nurse. So it would never right. be an LVN. So it seemed like Janine always kind of really wanted to be that charge nurse and wanted to be in charge. And but she didn't really have the credentials to do that at the time. Now, she was routinely insubordinate. Nobody wanted to challenge her, A, because she was kind of crazy and like aggressive. And if you challenged her, she would just... You know, flip her shit and fly off the handle. And also because, you know, she showed up to work extra. And so she was literally never disciplined for anything.
Isn't that interesting? You know, like, I guess that's something that's never really changed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you could just treat your coworkers the shittiest, but you go to work every day.
You go to work every day.
You
so
do all these hours.
You can literally do whatever you want. And unfortunately for Bexar, it included, you know, harming her patients directly. So with codes and lost patients, she was still overly emotional with every single one. And people who witnessed her reactions thought it was weird and borderline pathological.
Are they starting to think that they're not real?
Well, she would say she would have these like grandiose reactions like, why do babies die always when I'm around? And she would just like cry and seek comfort from the male staff and the male residents and the male doctors.
Did they give it to her?
Well, I mean, if she like played the damsel in distress so damn well. I'm sure she got it sometimes. Now, in May of 1981, the unit started having this rash of unexpected emergencies and very strange events. Now, kids that were not that sick started coding and dying left and right, including a three-week-old baby. This one was the first. The baby's name was Terry Lynn Garcia, and this baby was admitted for dehydration in the setting of a GI bug. And this baby mysteriously developed this severe bradycardia. And the following evening, the baby lost her pulse completely. And after 90 minutes of CPR, she was unfortunately declared dead on August 11th of 1981. From a GI bug, essentially.
Oh, poor thing.
So they had two more infants, Patricia Sambrano, who was 3 months old, and Paul Villarreal, who was 4 months old. Both of them died after developing similar symptoms only days later. Now, these babies would be admitted for something completely, you know, different and something they would be fully expected to recover from, only to develop these weird symptoms like bradycardia, which is,
you
know.
So what were they being given?
Exactly. So it just all seemed really bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
So doctors and staff began recognizing that ventilator settings would be changed improperly without any explanation whatsoever.
That's dicey.
It's real dicey. Dicey is a good word to describe it. Mm. So this eventually led to the death of a four-month-old baby named Placida Ibarra, who was under treatment for heart failure. And now when the resident noticed the ventilator settings, they noticed that...
Four-month-old for heart failure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that does happen, unfortunately. Now, they noticed that the ventilator was set to deliver 100% oxygen via her tube. Now, this is far too rich a concentration. When it's not needed, you don't give all that oxygen because it can create a severe acid-base imbalance, which can be fatal. Yeah. Now, in August, there were 9 infant codes. In September, there were 13 infant codes. Every single one of these were under some bizarre circumstance or just did not medically make a whole lot of sense.
So now suspicion is rising.
Exactly.
What's going on?
What's happening? So there was an infant named Jose Flores, 6 months old, who was admitted for a GI bug. Now, he died after a real horrific situation. Now, on his third day, while he was hospitalized under Janine's care, of course, he started developing seizures. And he began bleeding from all of his orifices. Now,
oh my God.
In addition, his heart stopped and he was coded and brought back. And once he became stable, though, he would immediately fall ill again and become unstable. And eventually, within that 24-hour period, he did pass away. So with all of these events, an entire committee formed consisting of... the hospital administration, Dr. Robitham, the PICU medical director, and the charge nurse. Now, they all started compiling timelines of all of these events. Now, this all took months because there were just so many events and so many cases to review. Mm-hmm. Now, there was things started to sort of kind of line up with Janine. Because of all of the documentation, the MARS that were all reviewed for months and months. Now, from the beginning, Dr. Robitham had a concern about heparin. Now, the babies often had lines that were primed with heparin to keep the line patent.
Keep it open.
Now, heparin is an anticoagulant. We discussed it in a previous case, but essentially, it's given in bigger doses to treat thrombotic events like heart attacks and strokes. But it's given in baby doses to keep lines patent and to keep lines from becoming clotted. All these babies who had central lines or arterial lines would get baby doses of heparin.
Just want to make sure they don't get clogged.
Exactly. Now, he was wondering if these kids were either accidentally or purposefully getting bolused with high doses. Now, in addition, a lot of these cases had arrhythmias, either tachyarrhythmias or bradyarrhythmias, meaning their heart rate would either be abnormally fast or abnormally slow. And this also led him to wonder about digoxin. Now, digoxin, we've also talked about in a previous episode, and it's a medication that is a cardiac glycoside. It is derived from the plant foxglove, which is a flower.
This is making me think of a conversation that I was having with a coworker, and he was talking about our podcast just as far as what he's seen. I don't think he's listened to the whole thing, but he was seeing some of the promos that we were putting up and whatnot and some of the descriptions, and he was just like, you know, now insulin, isn't that interesting? Like, now when do they get really creative with like dig? And I was like, oh,
oh, you just wait. Subscribe.
Yeah, he called it. He said the dig, and I was like, give it a minute.
These people learn and they adapt. Ugh. And digoxin is one of those drugs that is very mysterious because not a lot of people, I mean, Dr. Robitham did have an immediate suspicion. I think he was like, you know, a really intelligent guy and he kind of knew that, you know, this would be caused by that. Now, the digoxin is often given to treat atrial fibrillation, which is an arrhythmia, a rhythm disturbance that can cause your heart rate to beat irregularly and too fast. And what it does is it slows the conduction through the heart and therefore does slow down the heart rate. But given to somebody who has a normal heart rate, it can make it
too low.
Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets really dangerous.
Right.
So this is where I'm telling you the Charles Cullen vibes.
I know.
I'm getting it. So many bad things were happening to these babies that the residents that were taking care of the babies, the resident physicians, started keeping post by their patients. And they would rotate They would say, okay, you take the day shift, I take the night shift. I am not leaving this baby's side because this baby is not dying on my watch. And they just started watching.
And that's not normal for a physician.
Oh, hell no. You know what I mean? But they knew something was happening. And Dr. Robotham knew something was happening. So he was like,
staying on his residence. Yes. And be like, guys.
Watch every single patient. Watch every single nurse that goes in there. Watch every single medication administration.
Good for him.
Make sure it's getting done right. This guy gets shit done.
Good for them.
Yes.
Good.
Yes. So now there was some suspicion about Janine, like I said, and that was starting to get around the unit, and like her bizarre behavior, and she was so insubordinate and argumentative and sexually inappropriate. I mean, this lady was just really given weird vibes to everybody. Mm-hmm. So there were kind of some feelers out. There was no real hard evidence at this point. She was still, kind of doing her thing. So then another baby named Albert Garza, who was admitted for acidosis following a GI bug. Now, this must have happened during GI bug season. This is what happens.
Right.
So he started having a bleeding issue. Now, the resident doc was sitting but had gotten up to use the bathroom. Minutes after he returned, the child began bleeding from every orifice. Blood was pooling under this poor baby.
Guy's not even allowed to pee.
I know. So Dr. Yi was the name of the resident. And he thought real quickly, because he was also suspicious of the heparin, to draw some blood and to mix it with something called protamine sulfate. Now that counteracts heparin.
Okay.
So the baby's blood, he took some of the baby's blood, he real quickly mixed it with the protamine sulfate, it clotted immediately. Okay. So that was confirmatory that heparin was the culprit.
The reason for the...
Exactly. Okay. So this incident was documented. Robotham then had a little bit more fuel, but still no proof. Of course, guess who was working that night?
Janine
was working that night. So she was still constantly being caught up in lies. Like, some of them were just really stupid about literally everything. So one time, she handed a nurse a syringe and just said, here, push this.
Yeah, because that's a smart thing to do.
Like, here you go, push this. So she told the nurse it was dextrose and that she had just taken the baby's blood sugar and it was dangerously low. Now, the doc at the bedside was puzzled because there was no reason for the baby to be hypoglycemic. So he said, check it again if it was low. They checked it and it was completely normal. Like, Janine was just trying to get someone to administer something that would make the baby's blood sugar. Girls,
nurses,
don't ever... Go ahead, Devin.
Never give something you didn't draw up or grab yourself.
Okay, now a little louder for the people in the back.
Dude! Do not ever give a med that you did not get or draw up yourself. Can you hear me back there?
See Devin's fucking hands right
now.
Don't
do it. Don't let someone say, hey, can you go give this for me? Oh, sure. I'd love to.
Yes. Oh, my God. Devin, your hands were very exciting.
Spiel over.
So now, This added more fuel to the fire. So Robotham had his suspicions, but this was like, he was like, this is brazen. This lady has no boundaries, no sense of accountability at all for any of her actions. So Janine, though, when confronted about any of this, blamed the residents and the doctors. She was very vocal about this. She would say, the residents keep fucking up. And she would say that I'm not saying adding that for drama. She would say, everyone's fucking up and throwing me under the bus. And she just grew more brazen and more insubordinate as time went on.
Doesn't that make you more of the target, too, when you're deflecting it onto other people?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, girl, I mean, I'm not telling people how to be a serial killer, but like, maybe don't draw all that attention to yourself.
Right.
A little tidbit I'm just going to toss in there that is that one point Janine was hospitalized at a neighboring hospital for a small bowel obstruction. She spent 17 days in the hospital. And during her 17 day.
Anyone give her heparin?
No, I wish.
Darn.
During her 17 day absence from work, not one child coded or died on the PICU. So.
Doesn't
Dr. Robotham,
something?
Exactly. So Dr. Robotham spent some time reviewing 9 particular cases, okay?
All unfortunately, of which were Janine's, I'm assuming?
Yes, and unfortunately, all the evidence was circumstantial. They had no proof, no eyewitness accounts, so they were really stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Now, December 8th, Joshua Sawyer is admitted for smoke inhalation. Now, the smoke inhalation can at times trigger seizures, and that's what happened. So he was started on a few different medications, including Dilantin. Now, Dilantin is a medication that is an anti-seizure medication. It can also be given as a mood stabilizer, and it does have a measurable, quantifiable level in the blood that's often drawn to make sure that right. when we're giving the med, that it is in therapeutic range and it's doing and not what it's all, supposed to do.
So, like, not all meds have that, where no, you can check their level not. And make
exactly.
sure it's
good point.
So
good
that's
point.
Just something to point out. So I know we've talked about that with Didge.
Yes.
And now with Dilantin. But you can't do that with all meds.
No, you're absolutely right. And a lot of these meds where we can check levels, it's the purpose of checking the level is to make sure that it's in what they call a therapeutic range. Right. Now, if it's too high, it can cause toxicity. If the level's too low, then it's really not doing its intended purpose, mm-hmm. is the theory. So now the baby was on the Dilantin and he was sedated and on the ventilator in the hospital to protect his airway. Now, over the first 3 days of his hospitalization, he actually did really well. They were doing spontaneous breathing trials. He was starting to breathe on his own, and the docs were really hoping to get him off of the ventilator and extubate him soon. Then Janine happened. So she
fucking
took over
Janine.
Fucking Janine. I know, right? She took over his care on the 3-11 shift. And of course, things went completely awry. So he started becoming tachycardic and then he lost his pulse completely. And doctors thought at the time to draw a Dilantin level because he was on the medication for the seizures. And they said, you know, that sometimes tachycardia can occur in Dilantin toxicity. So while they were waiting for that code for that level to come back, he arrested a total of twice. And of course, stabilizing him, they were able to stabilize him, and then immediately he would become ill again. Mm. Now, days later, unfortunately, he did pass away. Now, when Dr. Robotham reviewed the case, the lab value had come back after Joshua had passed. So it was not realized in real time that the Dilantin level was high. And in fact, that kind of got buried because, you know, until Dr. Robotham really took an in-depth review, the baby had passed and there was really no reason to go back. Mm-hmm. So the Dilantin level was about 5 times the therapeutic range.
But they never really knew that
at the
time.
They never knew it at the time, exactly, because it takes some time for that level to come back. Now, remember, anytime she was confronted about her behavior, she would start to get real defensive. She would threaten the doctor. She started threatening people. She said, and I quote, "I have my little black book with every child death and it will incriminate you." And she would insinuate that the docs were the ones fucking up and that she was left to clean up all their messes. And she later admitted that that was a complete lie. She did not have a black book. She didn't keep track of shit. Now, Dr. Robotham had it in for Janine at this point. He was like, this person is the cause of everything. He knew it. I mean, he just knew by her attitude, her threatening behavior, and of course, all of these events that just mysteriously coincided with Janine being on, right? Mm-hmm. So despite his best efforts, though, and his dedication, I mean, he really spent a lot of months, a lot of time trying to get enough information to formally incriminate Janine for what she was doing. So he tried and tried and tried. But you know what happened? He was ousted by the hospital administration.
Why?
Because he had no definitive proof, and they saw it as he's getting obsessive. This is
a witch hunt.
Yeah. Exactly. So he was let go from being the PICU. I know. I'm so sad for this guy. I'm so sad. So he moved on to a research
lab. This is like
lab.
Another theme with the Cullen vibes,
yes.
too. If you've got all the circumstantial proof, but where's your hard case? Where's
exactly.
your hard thing that you can't deny?
Exactly.
And
so
in the meantime, yeah. until you get that, more and more patients are...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So he moved on to a research lab in Houston, and this kind of like ruined the hospital life for him. He was
he's
like, I'm
done. He
was beside
God.
Himself. He lost all faith in the system and was like, you know, it ruins me. It's really very sad. So many more kids would go on to die in this PICU. Now, with the absence of Dr. Robotham, who was like really driving this, you know, thing against Janine, you know, he's gone now. So, you know, no one's really looking at her under a microscope at this moment. So kids would almost die and die. And it would seem like they were yo-yoing between being fine and being critically ill within minutes and then go back and forth again. And it's been said that it was as if Janine was toying with them like a cat with a mouse.
Oh, come on.
I know. This kills me. It's so sad.
Come on.
It is so sad. So She managed to divide the staff, and she really staff split. And patients do this. We talk about this as nurses. You know, they would manipulate their ways into the good graces of certain people and blame other people and sort of create this whole facade of everybody's against me, but I'm really a good person and, like, you really know me type of thing. So she would, you know, gain the trust of some providers and then create a lot of Emily's. Enemies. No offense to any of those Emilys out there.
No.
Enemies. We love you, Emilys. Enemies along the way. So one of the residents that she worked with was a woman named Kathy Holland. And Janine struck up a real friendship with her. And she often talked about working with her together in the future. Now, Kathy was young. She was recently married. And she was just at the tail end of her residency in pediatrics. And what she really wanted to go into was outpatient pediatric, like, family practice.
Okay.
So her patients, while they were under Janine's care, all did well. So Janine was making sure not to sully that good reputation that she had with this particular resident.
Mm-hmm.
And thus Kathy trusted her because her patients weren't being targeted.
Fine.
She was like,
There was no reason to suspect Janine was any target.
Exactly. So maybe it really is the doctors on those other patients and cases that are fucking up, and Janine is just cleaning up their messes. So this just goes to show how manipulative this woman is.
Which she's been doing since her early teens.
Exactly.
She got really good at it.
Exactly. So now we're moving on to January 14th of 1982. So another baby. This time it was a surgical case. His name was Patrick Zavala. Was admitted after a repair of a rare cardiac birth defect. Mm-hmm. Now, the surgery was really invasive. It was a really big deal, but the procedure went really well. And he was stable. Good. So, of course, Janine took him over and his condition deteriorated. So
clearly he wasn't a patient of her favorite resident.
Yeah, exactly. Clearly. This was exactly. So the resident who was at the bedside was just completely at a loss as he was doing so well. And, like, all of a sudden he's just doing really poorly. So Janine is insistent on, we have to get him down for a brain scan. We have to get him down for a brain scan. And the guy's like, I mean... All right.
What did you do to his brain, Janine?
Yeah. That's like, what did you do? So the resident felt he was too unstable to go for a brain scan. He's like, we really shouldn't leave the ICU. He cannot travel anywhere right now. He's literally, like, about to code. So Janine was insistent and very manipulative, and somehow she got the resident to agree. So they were in the elevator, en route to CT, and of course his heart rate drops down, and then he loses his pulse completely.
In the elevator.
And of course they were in the elevator, so they did what they could, but he passed away. So as the doc was pronouncing, this woman and her drama and her theatrics, she pulls a syringe of saline out of her pocket and fucking holy water style squirts the sign of the cross on the baby's forehead and then on herself. And then she just says some kind of incoherent prayer.
Possessed much?
So weird. This is just an example, but this was how theatrical she was when someone died. And it was like all, she just, anything for attention, literally anything.
You're getting creepy on me, Janine.
Janine's been creepy since the day of her birth. So this is where we meet Dr. Kent Trinkle. And he is a very big and very scary surgeon who was very hot-headed and very deeply respected in his field. So surgeons sometimes have this personality type.
The hot-headedness.
Yeah. It's pretty typical in that field. Now, he had a temper, and the residents that worked with him, like, feared and respected him.
Right.
But again, he was very highly respected in the community and even in the surgical community as a whole. So he was actually considered San Antonio's counterpart to legendary surgeon Dr. Charles DeBakey. Now, for any of you who have worked in a surgical setting, you may find the name DeBakey to be familiar because the DeBakey forceps.
Clearly, I don't because it's a doctor.
Yeah. So the DeBakey forceps was named after Dr. Charles DeBakey.
Do you remember that from your OR days?
Yes, I did. I was like, oh, Charles DeBakey. He was the surgeon on this kid's case, and he reviewed the case, and he was livid that this kid died.
Because he's like, there's no way.
He waltzes on. Yeah, he was like, I mean, this surgery went even though it was a big deal, this surgery went as well as it possibly could have. There is never. And then there's also like this ownership that a surgeon takes over their patient. When they do some kind of procedure, it's like, this clinical course is all reflective of my care. So he took this very personally and he knew he gave good care. So he was like, oh, hell no. Hell no.
Who done it?
So he like waltzes into the PICU and just pulls every alarm, and he's complaining and he's making it a huge ruckus, and he wants to know everything about this case, who was taking care of him, and you know what mistake must have happened to result in the death of this child, because it certainly was not anything I did. So he immediately was suspicious that the baby was a victim of error. Now rumors started circulating back to him about Janine, because again, rumors are starting to cook on this unit, right? So he was pissed and immediately targeted Janine. Oh, yeah. He was like, oh, bitch, it's going to go down. So he started becoming very active in the anti-Janine movement that was happening on this floor.
Can we make a sign for that?
Yes. And he sort of re-raised this issue with administration. So remember, it had all sort of been closed down.
Right. Once they got rid of the first doctor.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, pathologists have said that in the history of medical serial murder at the time in 1982, historically, serial killers have used a single MO, like a single medication or a single group of medications or substances of choice. If what was suspected was true, like she was using Dilantin and dextrose and heparin and digoxin and literally anything she could get her hands on, she was what they considered to be one of the most sophisticated serial killers of all time.
And that's because she's using...
because she's so multifaceted. I was going to say,
it's almost like she's using different weapons.
Yes, and she knew how each and every single one of them worked and exactly what was going to happen, how to counteract it.
Make it hard to develop a pattern.
And how to play yo-yo with these kids' lives. One second they're doing fine, the next they're critically ill.
Like she's toying with them.
She's literally toying with these babies.
Fuck you, Janine.
We hate you, Janine. I think that this is a good place to pause for part two. And I hope that
take
a breath.
Take a minute.
Let's all just meditate on this, because
very hot.
This is just going to get a lot darker and a lot more horrible. And
I can't take any more.
Devin, you got this. Take a breath. Okay.
She's pissing me off.
Devin's really suffering over here. So let's all just take a moment and appreciate Devin for listening to this, because it is very distressing, but it's a very important story to tell.
Yes.
And these victims' families, take deep breaths. These victims' families are still out there. And there's a lot of them that cannot be medically or, you know, paperwork wise linked to Janine. But
so
the suspicions are there. I feel so terrible for these people. So, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more in part two about more of her crimes, her next venture after Bexar, which is all really interesting, her arrest. Her trial.
I can still feel it, building, and you just told me to take a breath.
Just take all the breaths. So, thank you so much for joining us today. So,
thank you for listening. I want to know, can you let us know, are you feeling the way I'm feeling? Because again, guys, we're doing these podcasts together, but the one who's not presenting, like, you're getting...
It's very alarming.
This is real
for the other person.
This is real time for me. I have no idea about these people. Like, I have a general, like, here's a synopsis.
Yeah.
But...
the details are very distressing.
I'm still fuming.
And this case in particular is very distressing. So I appreciate you sticking with us. And
what are your thoughts?
I know. We want to know what you're thinking. Go ahead and give us a follow and shout us out on Instagram. You can find us at MedCrimes Podcast. You can send us a Twitter at MedCrimesPC.
We're British.
You can find us on Facebook by searching MedCrimes Podcast. Or if you wish to become a Patreon, you can go ahead and visit www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. We would really appreciate your contribution, and it would maybe help keep us going so we
Thank
could
you
do
for
this.
Your support, guys. We appreciate it.
God, we love you all so much. We're having such a blast doing this.
Until next time.
Devin, one day we're going to get sued for you using that. It's fine.
Oh, really?
No.
Is that a thing?
I don't know. Probably. We're not popular enough yet, so you do you, girlfriend.